The following audio is brought to you by the Davenant Institute and was recorded at Davenant House. To learn more about or to support the Davenant Institute, go to davenantinstitute.org and scroll to Get Involved.
Thank you all for gathering with us again. My name is Ansi Kamel. I'm the editor-in-chief of the Davenant Press. And the senior editor of Ad Fontes. And if you listen to our podcast, the Ad Fontes podcast, you will know that that is my signature introduction. But I'm here to talk to you about Ad Fontes, the magazine, today. So Ad Fontes, to the sources. This has been integral, I think, to the mission of the Davenant Institute for a very long time. And basically what Ad Fontes is designed to do, as we say on the podcast, it's our goal is to not only introduce you to the sources, to not only go to the sources, but to try to think through the sources, right? To attempt to embody and apply what the sources have to say to us in our day today. And these sources, I mean, we've gotten a little bit more Catholic, small c Catholic, so to speak, about what counts as a source, I think, over time. You know, I mean, we used to be very focused on Protestant theology and just sort of like examining what various Protestant theologians said and then kind of, you know, maybe applying that. And now we're sort of expanding to be a little bit more capacious. So we have stuff that still focuses on Protestant theology and everything is sort of inflected, is sort of read according to, I think, you know, good Protestant distinctives. But we've branched out. So for example, Christopher Nolan's Batman series in the most recent issue of Ad Fontes is now a source that our president Brad Littlejohn has written about. Return of the Vigilante, an essay on the possibility of political judgment, which is really just Oliver O'Donovan, but he uses Batman as the hook. So we are very excited. Sorry?
O'Donovan
for the people. That's right, but we are very excited to announce, I guess, you know, formally for the first time today that the website is going to be relaunching. We're going to have a brand new Ad Fontes website by the end of the month. I'm told by our. Well, that's true, right? The publication is relaunching, but the website is launching for the first time. It's no longer going to be consigned to the blog portion of the Davenant Institute website. So be looking for that in the coming weeks. And if you're interested, we have issues of the print version of Ad Fontes, which is also getting a redesign. So you can buy these at the back table. The back issues are on the table, sort of to the right when you walk in, and the current issue is just straight back. And we've got all sorts of things. I mean, probably most relevant to this conference is we have an essay in the March 2020 issue by Roberta Bayer, The Art of Protestant Learning, which is essentially a kind of investigation of Protestant ideals of learning in Protestant lands after the Reformation. She focuses on England. So if you're interested in that, go check it out. And that's
the back issues are free.
The back issues are free. Yeah, and the new one is $4. Yeah. $30 a year, and then we will, with the website relaunch, you'll be able to see those options more clearly on the website as well. So,
how frequent?
It's quarterly. Yeah.
Bargain at twice the price.
Yeah, that's right. Anything else tonight?
No.
Okay. Well, and now it's my pleasure to introduce Joseph Minnick. He was my predecessor at the press, and he bequeathed a press in an excellent state to me, and I've tried to make good on that. But Joseph got his PhD at UT Dallas in intellectual history and has written a lot about questions about atheism and modernity and kind of our experience of the absence of God and sort of what it is about modernity that kind of makes this experience a problem for us and how we should go about thinking through that. Joe is a teaching fellow at the Davenant Institute now. He teaches classes at Davenant Hall, and he has his own podcast with Dale Stenberg, the Pilgrim Faith podcast, and he also has the
Plausible
Faith podcast, which is geared more towards people who are struggling with their faith. So without further ado, let's welcome Joseph Minnick.
Thank you. Thanks, Ansi. He's a much better editor than I am. I brought the fancy folder for you all. Nothing but the best for you guys. So this is a guided discussion, but like Alistair Roberts, what that really is going to mean is I'll talk for 20 minutes and then we'll have a discussion. Actually, I'll try to talk less than Alistair does when he does these things. It's good to see a lot of new faces. As one of the OGs of this particular posse, it's good to see all the new faces this year. And not knowing all of you, I suppose it is worth reassuring you that the flower shirt and sandals don't mean that the Marxist just walked up to the podium to give his perspective. I'm a boring fella and I have nothing emancipatory to say. The title of this session is The Classics, the Protestant, and the Proletariat. Marxist alarm bells go off again. I'm sorry, Dad, that's the last time. This is meant to be a guided discussion, so I'm going to spend 15 minutes or so introducing our topic with a few of my own thoughts, and then conclude it with a list of questions I think we can work through together. So I'm gonna offer a proposal, and then I want to give you all the opportunity to rip it up and say it misses the point, or suggest modifications or alternatives, or ideally the alternative is you can say, that's it, Joe, that's the piece we've been missing. To which I will say, thank you. You're welcome. There you go. So the classics, the Protestant, the proletariat. What am I trying to do there in putting those three phrases together? Here are the claims I want to very briefly develop. First, because modern people tend to be ideological, classical education can be and often is a tool of ideology. Second, the principles which animate the tradition of classical education, nevertheless, are precisely the antidote to ideology. And then three, clarifying precisely how this is so, I'll finally argue, helps us see in a single motion both what it means to be Protestant classical educators and classical educators who have something to offer even those who are in the trailer park. So all that in 15 minutes, you say. We'll see how I do. So we'll start one, ideology in classical education. Two, what it means to escape ideology and how classical education helps with this. Three, how this helps orient those who are not typical candidates of classical education. So let's start with the first part, ideology in classical education. So what do I mean by ideology? I'm using this in a way similar to say, Jordan Peterson's recent critique of its predominantly leftist variant. But in Peterson's critique, ideology is a sort of totalizing explanation of things, a system that enables its participants to possess, for the mere memorization of a few dozen terms, a universal decoder for reality. An elite apparatus that distinguishes them, distinguishes the possessor of the apparatus as awake from the sort of moral plebeians, you might say. So if you know how to say emancipatory, you know how to deploy power analysis from Foucault, and know a couple meta counter arguments, you can take all comers before they come. In the most extreme instances of this, a person becomes kind of ideologically possessed, unable to pass from rehearsing their robotic talking points to letting their hair down and having an ordinary human conversation that is open to surprise. So along with Peterson, of course, we can see that this is a well-known phenomenon on the right as well. It's not at all uncommon that persons fancy themselves as having a sort of totalizing interpretive system or tradition that makes sense out of all the facets of reality, and which tends to reduce the complexities of reality to a few neat boxes. So in some conservative circles, if you got four or five presuppositions in order, you can reduce all opponents to missing one of those commonplaces and treat those commonplaces as the secret key to knowledge. I've argued in some of my writing over the last year that I think Americans especially tend toward an ideological relation to the world because we are, of all people, the most disconnected from place. A culture defined by the automobile and an extreme sense of mobility, we therefore do not usually experience the sense of concrete roots that transcend any ideological reduction. We bond with others very typically over common beliefs, common interests, etc. And even before the internet, which has exacerbated this trend, America was already a nation largely defined by elective communities. by elective communities. We aren't limited, for instance, to two churches within walking distance, but to 2,000 churches within driving distance for most of us. And this has this has irreducibly changed just what it is like, what it means to go to church. But with the rise of the internet, the exchange of the embodied for the spectral has been a sort of juggernaut trend that corresponds to a massive growth, I think, in our civilization of a trend toward ideology. And this is both obvious in extreme instances. You know, you think of the radicalization of predominantly young men online or something like this. But I'm sure that all of us have noticed we ourselves, perhaps, in the last 10 years, becoming more agitated over ideas. And if not we ourselves, certainly our neighbors and certainly our civilization. The speed of ideological warfare is now the speed of the internet, which accounts in no small part for our contemporary entrenchment, disallowing, as a live argument does, the post-screaming match reflective moments that typically are the location of reconsideration and repentance. So what does this have to do with classical education? Well, in this civilization, in this existential universe, you might say, it is especially easy to imagine that classical education is sort of scripted as a story of the valiant knights of Western civilization who saved the sinking ship of Christendom from the stowaway Marxists. And maybe there is something to that narrative. I want to be sensitive to all the boomers. I'm kidding. I wore this just for you guys, okay? Maybe there's something to that narrative. But a classical movement that is fundamentally reactive, that is fundamentally the kind of the negative photocopy of any progressivist movement at any point in the last century, will tend toward ideology. And what I mean by this is that the great books, the classical languages, and the wealth of the tradition can themselves become instrumentalized, technicalized, frustrated in their innate potential, and rather forced to terminate in their import in producing the same style of intellectual compliance and in sort of sheepishness that is often criticized about public education. It is not at all uncommon for some, at least, not, I mean, this is not a universal statement about classical education, but it wouldn't be hard to find examples of classical educators who sort of speak of their programs as providing a sort of reality apparatus for the kids, and to measure success not by excellence of soul, as it were, but rather by forming people who have a high competency in community shibboleths, you might say. And ironically, and here I move into my second point, this obscures precisely the way the classical movement can, and sometimes is, actually a tool to fight our tendency to ideology. And here's what I'd want to claim. We could speak about the goal of education in all sorts of ways, you know, the cultivation of excellence in the soul, etc. But of central importance to anything that could plausibly be called classical education, and perhaps straddling whatever is thrown under that label, one could speak of a rather simple project, which is to cultivate in a human soul a free relationship to the word, and to do so primarily through the cultivation of good readers and good writers. In a word, the classical tradition, this is that without which you don't have the classical tradition, seeks to produce a competent dialogue with reality in the soul, largely through cultivating a competent dialogue with the text in front of you. And it seems to me that in this kind of singular truth, putting it that way, that we can discern a project which cultivates free men, and one which is simply, we can discern a project, we can distinguish projects which cultivate free men, and one which simply sort of public school with a different agenda. For it's a primal insight of those great readers of the text, the reformers and their successors, that the human relationship to the word in the internal forum of the conscience must ever remain a fundamentally free relationship. And this freedom is two-directional. I'll talk about it in two directions. On the one hand, the truth is only fully possessed when the principles of the word and that text are internally grasped and freely appropriated by the reader, the engager of that text. I lost my spot. I'll say that again. The truth is only fully possessed when the principles of the word in the text in front of us are internally grasped and freely appropriated. And so we move beyond grammar to dialectic and finally rhetoric. But this freedom is not realized by sort of beating the word into the shape of my expectations, which often happens in reading texts. Rather, my freedom is realized in the same way it's realized in an engaging conversation. It is elicited by the text's own insistence upon me, cultivating a relationship to the text that honors its insistence upon us. So approaching a text, one might say, like approaching a person, must be an occasion for openness to surprise. The ear is the organ of the Christian, Luther famously said. And Protestant culture was always a culture that developed refined listeners to texts and to the world. The rise of Protestant exegesis and the rise of the sciences, for instance, are not disconnected. And in this sense, the text itself is free. It does not come bound to what I impose on it, analogous, you might say, to that approach to the sciences which reduces the kind of raw material of nature to something which I can conform to my will. Rather, the text confronts us. It hits us afresh. It remains insistently itself despite our attempt to grasp and internalize it. It is not dead, but speaketh, to throw some KJV out there. This free relationship to the word, nevertheless, that free relation in the internal forum of the conscience does not negate the relationship between the text and tradition, however. I think that's crucial to say. Rather, it simply does not make of the tradition a sort of great hive mind, and a sort of outsourced understander that downloads its sort of external content to the student's mind by the mean of sort of Borg tutors. Rather, precisely the moment that a finite man sees the almost the burden of the free relation of the soul to the word. If he is wise and sees what that actually means, he will recognize his need for guides and will suspect that the whole tradition of man has probably figured one or two things out. One can defer to a tradition without outsourcing the conscience to it. And in fact, we do this all the time. That's the ordinary human relationship to tradition, in fact. And what this preserves is the tension between the word mediated horizontally and the word, you might say, interrupting vertically. This is most obvious of all with the scriptures, of course. On the one hand, we don't approach the Bible without a horizontal reception of the wise Christian dialogue with that word through time, diachronically. Nevertheless, the tradition does not limit the word or contain it. Rather, in each encounter with it, with the word, there is an element of apocalyptic interruption. The word of God smashing into our world, making it new and summoning us more deeply awake. The word of God is living and active and sharper than any two-edged sword, as the author to the Hebrews puts it. And this logic, to some extent, extends further. The great texts of the tradition are, in their own way, living. They're the great texts precisely because they are not reduced to their commentators, but address the freely dialoguing soul in an endlessly contemporary fashion. So Plato, in that sense, is not just our father, but he's also our brother. We still talk with him because he continues to be fresh, you might say. He's continued to do that for 2,500 years in a contemporary way. Okay, so where are we in my preliminary comments here? We can be ideological with classical education, but classical education also creates the possibility, I think, of overcoming this. Remy Brog, in fact, defines the essence of Western civilization as, we can talk about this in the Q&A if you want, as precisely being the sort of civilization that is open to what is outside of it, as open to surprise at the text of reality. Western tradition has always been open to reform, not to revolution, of course, but reform is actually built into the authentic project, which is not often said in a lot of analyses of Western civilization, which almost treat it as a kind of arrived state, as it were. Authenticity to the tradition, then, is not merely to seek to produce regurgitating foot soldiers, but rather men and women who have learned to sit before texts and listen to them and respond to them competently. This dialogue does not terminate in the relationship between, nevertheless, man and book, but continues between man and reality and man altogether. Perhaps we might say that we're kind of hand-holding persons through learning how to freely dialogue with the Logos in all of its modes of presentation, precisely so that men become wiser, preserving what is good and helping us repent for where we as a civilization miss the mark. the tutor then isn't the kind of arrived one showing you, you know, how to prove predestination for Augustine or how to refute that one section of Marx or the problems with Rousseau's worldview, Colin. Rather, the tutor is a tour guide through an exotic universe which does not reduce the text even to his or her own understanding. And I think that's crucial in good pedagogy. Opinions must be shared and argued for and debated, of course. And we can insist that some readings are better than others. And there are good standards for determining this. But ideology must fundamentally approach the text as pre-digested. That's the move, usually, in ideological education. The text just is the foil for my understanding of it so that you memorize what to say when you read this guy, you know, Hume or whatever it is. And it will... What that does, though, is it trains us. The danger there is that actually trains you inevitably, even if you're learning your good Greek and Latin, to approach the world and what is most scandalous, to approach an actual human face. A living prophet, priest, and king also is pre-digested. Humans aren't surprising. We know exactly, we've been trained to say we know exactly where they're coming from. Jordan Peterson, one of his, it's not here, but one of his rules that I think is very interesting is always think that it's possible that any face that's in front of you might have something to say to you. And I think that's a very deep insight, very crucial for us, especially now. We're the worst at that, actually. A free relation to the word, nevertheless, does not guarantee avoiding ideology. Who can deny the convenience of ideology? But it is that without which we cannot be free of ideology. And so I'm not a Peterson fanboy, but it turns out this is just what he talks about. So I'm going to tell him, he's an interesting example of somebody who recognized what's wrong with contemporary ideology. All of us draw the line in our own place, but I find it interesting when he sort of became famous. What is it that sort of was the catalyst, as it were, for his rise to fame? And it was the moment that the kind of progressivist woke movement sought to play manager of the free human relationship to the word. It was the moment they said, here's what has to come out of your mouth. The relationship you have to the word isn't free. It's sort of manager. It's sort of managerializedand he was quite explicit. This is demonic. Once you sever the free human relationship of the word, or try to, you're going to admittedly be in a demonic project. We can admit with James, of course, the Apostle James, that this free relationship to the word is the site of primal abuse. With our mouths we curse, we harm. Only the perfect man controls his tongue. And yet it's also the ground zero of our healing and of our dominion. If the ear is the organ of the Christian, the tongue is the first symptom of the Christian life, for it's with the tongue that we both curse, but also bless and confess that Jesus is Lord freely. If nothing else, the tongue is an area in which mutual sovereignty must be recognized, and I think the traditional conservative emphasis on limits burns the brightest. As I've reflected on these things in the past few years, and now I'll just briefly strike my third point, it struck me how relevant this simple claim is to the wide variety of circumstances that fall outside the typical purview of what we call, you know, kind of the classical education movement. If this were a paper, I'd call this section Education from Highland Park to the Trailer Park. Highland Park is the richest neighborhood in the Dallas area, which probably puts it high in the running for one of the richest neighborhood in these United, for now, fingers crossed, United States. What I find interesting about this emphasis on the word is that I think it has something to say to educators engaged in sort of Mach 15, elite 19th century style classical education, and educators who get that one class to talk to mostly disinterested early 20-somethings at a community college. I think there's something to say to both of those people, or the mom trying to educate a kid in a trailer park. Whatever one's educational circumstances, one is moving toward the good, the true, and the beautiful. One is fulfilling a key object of education. One is, as it were, resisting the tidal sweep of the modern Leviathan, precisely to the extent and at any moment that they handhold a human through surprise at an encounter with the word, and then train them in the art of responding to that word competently and well. once again, precisely to discover such freedom, to really grasp it as a moral adult, is to feel both the wonder but also the burden of it. Free as I am, wondering as I am but a single man living a single life. I am like the eunuch in the wilderness, agitating about the text of reality in front of me. Who will help me understand it? The tradition is a whole host of Andrews, like Andrew Fulford, swept into our headspace who can help us, in which any sane person realizes that they must inevitably need. And it is here that access to a more rigorous education is so especially helpful in aiming the free soul with the wisdom of all of those Andrews consolidated in the tradition and bequeathed by tutors. Nevertheless, it's crucial to note that what is prior to this and how this can help us identify sort of the good when we see it, to take encouragement and give encouragement. I think this is especially important for pastors in our complex context. Where can we give encouragement to people in just a very wide variety of educational circumstances and projects? So I hope it's all right to give. I'll give two brief examples from my own life. I would not say that I received a classical education. I was homeschooled in the 90s. But in a family that could basically afford no tutors and by parents who were without a college education. My mother's parents did not even have a high school education. But for all the limitations of my education, one thing my parents always permitted was reading whatever I wanted to read in order to satisfy any sincere inquiry. My church community was also very much the sort of church that was always kind of arguing about the Bible. And caught up in that heritage, it only took a little curiosity, a library, and the internet to be set on some trajectory toward this flower shirt wearing guy that's standing in front of you. One more anecdote, though. I had the opportunity to teach community. I've mentioned this to a couple of you already. I had the opportunity to teach community college for a semester a year and a half ago, and this was not the good kind of community college. This was about as economically depressed and uneducated as community colleges get. This was arguably the bottom of public collegiate education. The half of the class that did show up was mostly high. But I've also seen a young man who would never otherwise be reading him become profoundly moved by reading a small portion of Plato. And speaking for myself, I suspect, in fact, that economically underclass minorities who are being shoved wokeism and, you know, STEM education all over the walls of the community college, when you introduce them to something that has deeper gravity than getting sort of assimilated into the Borg, it's actually quite enlivening. And in fact, I suspect a lot of them are especially hungry to be treated like their world, their lives are serious. Serious and that they're not just sort of drones in a big system. Basically, I think to be introduced to a freedom of soul of sorts. So what's the import of this last paragraph? What's the point? Sometimes the classical education movement can be afflicted with the impression that there is but one educational project to be had out there, and it must be the most rigorous one. The educational solution to the world's problems is an intrinsically elite program, as it were. This has kind of cryptically come up a couple times already. And to be sure, I'm very happy that elite education exists. And yet, as an army has its kind of special and its ordinary platoons, so several types of tasks can be united under one strategy of a general. Analogously, in my judgment, the kind of one, at least one core insight of classical education, there is a core insight of classical education that translates all the way from the highest version of this to the ground. And while not at all denigrating the energy that refuses to kind of compromise excellence, somebody mentioned Cronman earlier, great book, we don't live any longer in an era where we simply have kind of the educated and the uneducated. Rather, we have the highly educated, the barely educated, the uneducated, and a million layers in between, in just a big, vast continuum of circumstances. We also have a million, for that reason, a million classical education projects in between. How rigorous are we supposed to be? At what point do we say that that's a crappy program, that's not a crappy program? And to who? For whom? And I'm arguing that we can perhaps identify what nevertheless animates and unites each of these, in principle at least, or might unite them in principle. Maybe that's a more cautious way to say it. And that is that they each seek to create the fruits of encounter with texts, the encounter with the text. A high school literature professor I wrote this actually before I just met one, a high school literature professor at Obadiah levels of hiddenness in the system may very well be doing the Lord's work precisely to the extent that they make their one class the single site of refreshment in a sea of ideology. Don't underestimate the amount of people who are called to holy subversion. Because even if most people won't do it, it only requires a superficial gander to see that if one for one were to bastardize Ratatouille, a good reader can come from anywhere. All right, so let's talk about this. I've made 3 points, but there's two of them blend together, so I'll blend them together in a kind of dual question, and then we'll go on to a second question. So one, can classical education be a project against its very own principles of making ideologues? Is it also the solution to that? Is that claim correct? So I'm interested in your feedback on that. You're welcome to disagree with me. And if so, if that's true, to what extent is it true also, and that's the other thing I want to talk about, is it true that there is something about creating a relationship to texts, creating a relationship to human interpretation, if you will, free, self-possessed human interpretation, that might help us identify what the Lord's work is wherever we find it across the many educational circumstances in our civilization? So let's start with the first one. Talk to me about classical education and ideology and in the ways in which classical education can actually prevent and be an antidote to ideology. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, to jump in, I really appreciated how you framed that. And this isn't, I think this is just saying what you said in a different way, but the first part, which is kind of a more of a descriptive of how Christian classical education has been kind of co-opted by the worldview movement to make it into its own form of ideology, which you know, but what's the, you know, you don't read Kant, you just read what this Christian guy said, Kant said,
yes,
and why it was wrong.
Or you read Kant and the tutor is like, here's what Kant means and here's why he's wrong.
So that would be, if we're asking the question, is that part of the essence of classical education, or is that just some sort of bad fruit from a different root?
Yeah, that's what I would want to say is, yeah, I think the fact that you're reading Kant is a good thing. The fact that you're opening up a text and you're trying to like engage a great thinker, and it's not even that a tutor can't say like, here's my reading of Kant. Even if this is the standard reading of Kant, here are the critiques. I think the critiques are compelling. That's fine, because you're still, the text still has its own kind of sovereignty over that exchange, and is in fact a lot of good educators typically are inviting the students, not in the sort of like, what does this mean to you, Sally? What does this mean to you, Joe? Like that's not quite what I'm saying. Nevertheless, the text, long-winded way of saying yes, those are very separable things. I don't think there's anything about classical education in principle that causes this problem. But I think it's the trick of the devil, as it were, to take all the good toys and ruin them. And this is one way of ruining the good toys. Yeah.
So what I would say, just as a follow-up, would be, I think the ethos that you approach classical education with determines which way you're going to go. And what I've found is that you've got fear and you've got courage. And so it's often approaching these texts through fear, which is, that's the I need to tell my students exactly what I think it says and why it's wrong, because I'm afraid that if they just read the text and try to understand it for what it is, you know, it might corrupt them or something like that. And so I've seen it's the ethos of fear that's taken it the ideological direction, which,
right,
ideology is almost always driven by fear.
But ironically, that posture usually masks itself with a bravado.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah, this is courage,
and
yes.
And it tries to appeal,
yes,
to it, says we need, you know,
yes,
we need to have the confidence to just tell it like it is.
Yes.
But that also drives a lot of, that's the reason why all the parents are driven to classical schooling.
Right.
Yes.
Because it's the, I want my child protected, right, in some respects. And therefore,
yes,
in what you're talking about, you're actually giving what the parents are looking for in that sense, because both sides are being driven by fear.
There's a market and a product for that market. And right, I like the way you fear and courage, but I do think there is a real courage to approaching a text and sitting in front of it and actually allowing it to do its own work on us. I've just read an account of an atheist who decided to read the Bible, in fact, and got converted because he thought all these arguments were wrong, and he opened the Bible and he started flipping through, and the Bible was more profound than any of the critiques of the Bible. It was the text itself that... But yes, with Brad, though, I'm very suspicious of 90% of the time a sort of bravado-ish character on the internet uses the word courage. Really what they're doing is calling cowardice courage. Ansi.
Okay, so just to kind of like take this in a slightly different direction,
yep.
I guess I have a set of related muddled thoughts that maybe you can kind of help me.
Sure, see what I can do.
So texts, I think, as Professor Downey, we were talking about Dante and his presentation said that texts have power, and I think we all recognize that. But the classical texts, those that we commonly call classical, have power for good, to give life and to kill, right? I mean, they're a mixed bag, so mm-hmm. to speak, right? You read Plato's Republic and you get the cave and you also get infanticide, right? No, I'm serious, right, Michael? I mean, I'm not wrong, right? You get the cave, you get infanticide, right? But I mean, which is just a kind of, I think, particularly the fact that those are so close together, in the same text is kind of interesting. And I know there are debates about how to read them. But anyway, my point is to say I generally like what you're saying about posture towards these texts, but I also think that there does have to be a kind of, or do you think there has to be a kind of care taken when we're transmitting what's in them, so that we're not assisting the corruption of our children by teaching them the classical texts in a particular way. And I guess, maybe put it this way. So I remember I had a conversation with a mentor of mine, a Catholic priest, and he said, look, it's like you can't expect Christians from different denominations to really understand each other. He said, in the early 1900s, a Presbyterian might have two good reasons why he wasn't a Catholic, and a Catholic might have two good reasons why he wasn't a Presbyterian. But neither of them really actually understand
right.
the sort of really high-level stuff that's going on that's being duped out by rival theologians. But that was enough for them. Right? They had two sort of reasonable, then reasons, and that was sufficient. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, is there a danger in sort of trying to get the lay Presbyterian to so to speak, in this analogy, to get the kind of full version of the argument, when really what he needs is just a couple of decent reasons not to be a Catholic or vice versa? Are we sort of in trying to give all of our students the fullness of the classical tradition, potentially opening them up to things that they won't be equipped to handle properly?
Yeah, it's a great question. I should add for the microphone. I'm going to repeat the question here. You tell me if I get it right, because this is being recorded and because it's a conversation, they want it in the recording. As I gather, what you're asking is, yes, the reading of text could be argued to be a solution, but it's also dangerous. So, like, you could imagine somebody saying, don't we need a tutor to kind of break it down into three sort of not the dangerous route talking points for mostly the masses who, let's be honest, aren't going to become experts in Plato. Yes, I think it depends more specifically on exactly what we want to say there. Most of what I would hope a good classical education would produce is definitely the tutors are very, very, very crucial. So whether it's just conceptual breakdown or whatever, but I think what a good tutor can do is give you a kind of handle on complex material, give you a kind of pathway to enter the text, but in such a way that they can let go of your hand and you can run free in the text. In other words, it's not the handle really is a walking alongside of you to help you get into the text and to receive, like, here's, it's totally legitimate for a tutor to say, hey, this is a dangerous import of this text and we wouldn't want to go there. you know, Plato thinks this. I think that's a, I think that's kind of a gross thing to think, actually. Don't kill kids, you know, etc. And that's totally legitimate. But I think that I would almost be reticent to break it down in terms of bequeathing maybe a set of broken down talking points for the masses. Or that's not quite what you're saying. But simple formulaic gestures are useful, but I think they need to be seen as and internalized by the by those same people. No, so for instance, nobody should walk around saying, "Here are the two reasons I'm not Catholic," and also, and I say that as somebody who understands Catholicism, because no, you don't. You actually don't, and that's just true. And so we want them to be right about their status. And I think what a good classical education might do, like good tutors, again, you might have good guidance through the texts. Nevertheless, what it can produce in people is actually having less opinions. Actually, what it can do is expose you to a world of discourse that's like, these are the perennial questions. I mean, Plato is, you know, going through all these, you know, ways of organizing a polis. And actually, it seems to me like one of the real effects of carefully reading these texts, carefully reading Aquinas, you carefully read Plato and Aristotle, is even if you're not persuaded, you might walk away saying, what do I know? Which is a good thing. Because, like, one of the symptoms of the fact, I think, that we're tend toward ideology in our own moment is that our pattern, especially, I think, culturally, I think we can all see this, everybody thinks they're supposed to have an opinion about everything. And actually, the thing is a wise person doesn't have an opinion about everything, because the wise person knows that there's just ton that they're not that competent in. So you could say, like, here, so one way to do that would be to say, I'm not a Catholic. Catholics, as far as I know, do this thing. And I am against that for this, that, and the other reason. But I don't want to pretend that I'm some expert in Catholicism, because I'm not. And we should be able to know when we're not and be okay saying that we're not.
Right. I guess, so how would you, I think I agree with that, but then how do you coordinate that with your claim that the goal of classical education is, in a sense, for a tutor to walk a student to walk with them long enough such that the student gains this kind of independence to run freely through the text? I mean, because I guess my concern is that not everyone is going to be up to that. I mean, it's a kind of Herculean task.
Yes.
Right, to say run through.
Let me clarify. I don't mean to suggest that you know, teaching Plato at a community college, you're going to get a student to walk through Plato's text really carefully and well. What I mean is you're going to train them simply. It doesn't even need to be Plato. It could be Harry Potter, for crying out loud. But it's simply getting them to open a text and respond to it well. So in other words, it's not necessarily, what I'm really trying to get at is actually just the encounter with the word itself, being engaged with perennial questions and having your mind smashing into that sort of thing is itself, just by itself, even if you don't arrive at deep understanding, itself intrinsically good and sort of virtue forming. Lynette?
Yeah. Justin has something on.
Oh, sorry, I'm interrupting myself with my phone. Okay, so Justin, and then I'm going to come back to Lynette. Okay.
I think, you know, to kind of quasi-address what you're saying, obviously, but also, like, the single greatest, I guess, enemy, if you want to talk about ideological enemy, is our chronological snobbery, right? We are the new man. Like,
yeah.
We create the world in our own image. And when I've exposed my student, I'm the Obadiah.
He's the Obadiah. Literature professor at a high school. He's my hero now.
When I expose my students to the past, and I show them how Achilles' response to the death of Patroclus is the response they had when their cousin was murdered 2 weeks ago, it suddenly humanizes the past. And they see how the past and the present are not really that different. And so it kind of attacks and eats away at the ideological presupposition that, like, all things new are good, and we are the new, and the past is dead. right? Which is a lot of the progressive project is to like erase the past.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing good there, right? Only things that are new are good.
Mm.
And so I do think that there's something about just exposing anyone, everyone to that. Because certainly the other side is not afraid to expose anyone and everyone to their ideas.
Right.
Right. They feel like it's good for everyone to be taught these things.
Right.
So, you know, on the other side, exposing students to that, of whatever level or degree or ability, has like a certain kind of cleansing effect. You know, it causes, oh, wait, you mean like this thing written 3,000 years ago in another place in a different language?
Yeah.
People are, well, they're like me.
Right.
There's a connection that's established there.
Well, and this is what we were talking earlier about. Part of the thing with Protestantism was just getting people to read the Bible. And Du Bois was mentioned, but also Frederick Douglass, I think, you know, treats his own kind of moral conversion to just being able to read. I mean, it wasn't that having a tutor walking him through Plato. It was just the ability to engage intelligent thoughts, have the access to thoughts that were not his own, sort of smashing into him, that was the catalyst for insight. Lynette, and then I'll go to Clifford. Is that right? Yep. Okay. So Lynette.
So I was just going to say, it seems to me that the difference is, like, on one hand, looking at, like, I'm just downloading, like, I think the modern notion of a teacher is that I'm just downloading this material and passing it on to my students.
Right.
And so then I'm passing on this ideology to my students, when maybe what we should be thinking about is this really scary metaphor of cultivating the human soul.
Yeah.
And so when we come to our students, we're more interested in their formation than we are in bringing this material to them.
Right.
So if we present the text to them and they read that text and then they tell us what they saw in that text.
Right.
Now we know what's going on in the back of their mind, and we can engage in a discussion with them.
Right.
And if we're presenting Plato to them, and they're not seeing like infanticide as a bad thing, we probably shouldn't be presenting Plato to them.
Yes.
Probably jumping the gun and going way too, like, they.
Right.
That
could be they can't handle it.
We failed way earlier, so they're not ready for Plato, so we should not be presenting Plato.
Right.
So we see how they respond, and then we realize we've gone too far. If that's the conversation we're having.
Yeah.
So it's a difference between the modern notion of just downloading info and but actually seeing our role.
Right. And I think one thing I'll add to that is there isn't any safe way to educate. I think that's really crucial for us to say, like, you know, if you raise kids and they get older and they walk out of the house, if you're making a free, if you're cultivating a free, competent soul, that is a soul that intrinsically can disappoint and scare you. and so what you're doing is trying to be a guide to what is, the souls of your children already are free. in a Protestant theology, right? And that is a scary thing, because that means you're not in control of that free relationship to the Logos. And what you're doing then is not, the moment you try to overly managerialize that, what inevitably happens, and we've seen this over and over and over and over again, is they do the teenager thing. They say it for till they're 18. They leave home, and then they go alter ego swing to something else. But if you're a guide, I think if you have to take the posture of, okay, you have that scary freedom that mommy and daddy ultimately cannot control, and your tutors ultimately can't control. And so what I actually have to do is be a magnanimous leader whose trust is earned, because I am walking alongside you as you freely and uncoercedly internalize these truths that I want you to internalize.
And I recognize the whole time that ultimately the Holy Spirit.
Yes, that's right. Yes. Me. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's right. Clifford.
Yeah, two quick points, but just first on the nature of teacher as interpreter or guide, I often reflect on George Orwell and Aldous Huxley wrote similar novels.
Right.
Most people know, or maybe they don't know, I don't know, but Huxley was Orwell's teacher in high school at Eton.
Oh!
What's interesting is, you know what his subject that Huxley taught? French. I mention that to say, you can be teaching a text, you could be teaching a language, and what is conveyed to the student is something much more influential than that.
Right.
But they're being encouragement to all teachers.
Yes.
What you're teaching.
Yes.
And that they kept up. I mean, when Orwell wrote 1984, he sent Huxley a copy of it. And, you know, they corresponded. Huxley told him why he was wrong and all this. So just the nature, a teacher, just even if he's teaching French, I think is going to be teaching so much more of his person. And
that's right.
And it's mysterious.
It is. Yep.
And then the two other things, something I'm not quite sure on, and I missed the very beginning, so forgive me if you're covering.
No worries.
It seems to me that there's sort of ages and stages of development. Not to go into the trivium discussion we had earlier, but like certain things. The role of teacher seems to be different for a 7-year-old than it would be for an 18-year-old than it would be for a 21-year-old.
Mm.
And that we can't, I think we're falling into our own ideological thinking. We're thinking we need a straight method that we can apply at all times.
Right.
I think that there's more of a need for the teacher to be an interpreter, more active interpreter at the younger stages than
right.
at the older ages, and where you can maybe let the author of the text be the teacher more in those stages.
Yeah, I appreciate that qualification. That's right. Yeah, I mean, and that's right. You know, parenting on the one hand, that souls of your kids are free in a Protestant sense, but right, you actually do just tell your kid, here are the three things you have to do and learn and memorize because you do. Sorry.
Right. And then the final thing I'll mention, the reading that we had in the gospel this morning. It's one of the most frustrating. Jesus, what are you doing? He's purposely trying to convey something in a parable so that they'll have eyes and that they won't see, they won't perceive. And what I see, and someone talked about, I think Dr. Beeth mentioned Socrates and Alcibiades. I think what I see in Plato is Socrates giving different teachings to different students. And I see Jesus doing the same thing.
Mm.
A master teacher doesn't employ an ideological method for all of his students.
Right.
He's able to perceive differences in students.
Right.
And some of them need a certain kind of a teaching than others.
Yes.
And so
yes.
That's left to the prudence of the teacher. There's no method.
Yes. Yes. I think that's a crucial one, for instance, application of that. So I'm talking about the free relationship to the word. If we really wanted to get kind of more abstract, ascend the ladder of being, as it were, we might just say a free relation to the logos. But the logos can manifest in any text, any experience, any craft, in a sense, in one sense. And for that reason, it's not just that a good reader can come from anywhere, but a good text can be almost anything depending on the teacher and the student, as prudentially appropriated rightly in a particular circumstance. So there's some students for whom the catalyst to learning and a good tutor exactly is looking for that. They're either looking for the perfect text for that guy, the perfect image for that guy, or the perfect whatever catalyst for their
right.
self-appropriation, or the appropriation of the logos, really.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of in the Phaedrus, Socrates is explaining the origin of writing.
Right.
And he talks about it as a curse, because anything that you write says the same thing to every person. And I think that's why Plato wrote in dialogue form, so that it says different things to different people. It's not a treatise.
Mm. Yes, I think that's true. Yeah, that's. Thank you. I think that's fascinating. I think, yeah, Plato writing in dialogue. Yes. Yeah. Good.
Go ahead. To your first question, the first thing that came to my mind is you said, well, I forget exactly how you phrased it, but something about classical education, excuse me, not execution.
they got rid of hanging.
Classical education functioning as ideology. Something like that. So my question is it really, if that's what's happening, is it really classical? Because, you know, if... In fact, any kind of, because if what's happening, whether it's intentional or not, is the pushing of ideology, is that really education or is that indoctrination?
See? Yeah.
And I'll just say one more thing.
Yeah.
Isn't the role of the educator to teach their students how to think, not just what to think about this?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
If I'm If I'm focused on always in front of my class saying this is what you need to think about this, and trade that off for this is how to think.
Yeah.
I think that's indoctrination.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you ask, like, is it one of the things, and the historians or the people who are more historically aware in the room might have something to say about this, but I'm actually fascinated. I use the phrase classical education in this presentation, but when you say, is that really classical? One of the things I kind of wonder is any classical education movement right now classical, or is it all modern? Meaning, like, who is actually, you know, Michael Lynch just described a program of education, and my question is, where does that exist anywhere? And the answer might be almost nowhere. So whatever is calling itself classical education, if we were using that as the standard, is an adjustment of principles to a particular circumstance. And we can say whether that loses the spirit or you know, the circumstance is just the husk or whatever. But right, yes, I do think, again, like, I don't want to get away from saying the tutors, I think a good tutor will give you their opinions. Students are usually curious. Yeah, and that's, but right, but yes, but the goal is not, in fact, just to bring you to the kind of wisdom of the tutor, but actually to give you the tools to exceed the tutor. Yeah. And that's the other, yeah, that's the other
which
element
I,
there.
Which I think I really appreciate. What is his name?
Clifford. Clifford
yeah,
Humphrey,
the
yeah.
Point, which, that whole point was very well
yeah, made. I think that's excellent.
So we just have a couple more minutes.
One more. Yes, sir.
The way we're talking about classical education right now narrows not necessarily the content, but the goals. In a way, it broadens it, but it's,
yes.
It can't just be either quadrivium, or trivium, or Roman. But what we're talking about is faith-seeking understanding. We're talking about philosophy. We're not just talking about doing logic or doing a definite discipline or having read a book or a worldview. So the issue with that is that that's the version of classical education I think of, or the liberal arts I think of, but not everyone's coming in with that expectation. And so I think it's important that we realize, as you've said, there's different students who are coming into the room, and some are going to be Thrasymachists, and they will not respond, and then they'll just shut down.
Yeah.
Some are going to be there and say, just tell me what I want to hear.
Yep.
And some will come up. And that's part of the realization, is that,
yes.
This might mean, as education at the college level, that people come in, if they're coming in because of what parents have expected sometimes,
yes,
or what they've expected, which is, they, in some ways, they expect a certain kind of theological indoctrination, which we want to provide that in the best sense.
Right.
That they're getting good theology. But that what we're asking of students when we do this is something not every student is willing or capable of giving. I don't mean capable at their soul's faculties don't have the power.
Right.
For whatever effective or expected reasons they're coming.
Yeah. I think those are perennial and crucial. I think those are crucial considerations. I think what I would say, yeah, I mean, first of all, certainly one thing you said that I think is just a universal experience of teachers is half of your students are going to be bored and go home. You know, like, it's very rare to be a teacher where all the students are, except at Davenant Hall. We have a good crew at Davenant Hall. thank you, brother. But right, average classroom experience is going to be the average student just wants to do the thing, get by or whatever, and it's going to be the occasional student, you know, and the teachers teach for that occasional student. That's really what gives teacher satisfaction, is that.
You get to love them all.
Yes.
You get to walk with them.
And hopefully plant seeds.
To come fully alive
to, that's right.
To the calling you, of faith-seeking understanding.
That's right.
In the sense that this is,
yes,
talking about.
What I, the only thing I would add is I do worry is the wrong term, but I would want us to kind of doubly and triply ask ourselves whether people are more enlivable than we suspect. So a lot of times you sort of get, I think, teachers that are sort of like, well, I want to come in and do my Latin conjugations or whatever, and if your soul doesn't get enlivened by that, well, that's your problem. You know, it's like, well, there is actually that Yeah, I don't have a lot. I don't have a lot to say to that. All I'd want to say is I do want to say that I do think that we, and especially us, again, I'll go back and just say modern people especially, we're very cynical. We tend to think we understand people. We tend to think, well, those people, you know, most of them probably aren't gonna. But the truth is people are actually very surprising sometimes. And I think that I think if a tutor has the kind of open heartedness to approach students, kind of in general, that way, you're going to get, you know, something like the best result. Assume that I could speak to them and even try to, you know, use different catalysts to get them to respond. But right, I mean, you can't guarantee it. And as Clifford was just saying, it's not really even at that point a method, right? You can't contain the word if it can't be contained in a tutor or a tradition. It also certainly cannot be contained in a method. And so you're trying to be the occasion, perhaps, if God wants to descend for the Logos to make somebody alive, in, you know, and I'm speaking analogously, of course, there.
We're gonna wrap up there.
Okay, cut it up. Thank you, brethren.
Thank you for listening to this audio from the Davenant Institute. You can find more resources from the Davenant Institute on Facebook, our podcasts, and the Davenant Press. We invite you to subscribe to our newsletter at Fontes or read our blog, both available on our webpage. To support the Davenant Institute, go to davenantinstitute.org and scroll to get involved.